Hello listeners, and welcome to a very special episode of Sportspiel. Since we started the podcast back in 2017, we have been fortunate to tell some very incredibly powerful and moving stories, and this is another one of those. A report released in May 2020 suggested that as many as 1.4 million people in the UK could be classified as problem gamblers. Indeed, gambling addiction is believed to be one of the fastest growing mental illnesses in this country at the present time. Former professional cricketer Patrick Foster is one of those who has suffered through gambling. After his sporting career was ended overnight, he began a tumultuous journey that would see him experience the rare highs and the frequent extreme lows that betting provides. Over the next hour, he talks honestly and bravely about his own experiences and how his gambling started off as a way of getting his competitive fix before it cost him his job and very nearly his life. Patrick now spends his time teaching people across the country about the dangers of gambling and is also an ambassador for our brilliant partners at the Mintridge Foundation. We are releasing this episode in conjunction with their 28 Not Out event, raising money for the Max Hunter Fund. Max died by suicide aged 28 in 2019, and now Mintridge, who he was a huge supporter and friend of, want to help his memory live on by encouraging people to enter into dialogue around how to look after our mental health through sport. So, without further ado, here is our interview with Patrick, and we hope you find it as inspirational and informative to listen to as we found recording it.
Patrick, welcome to the podcast, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking some time out to obviously be a part of this and for telling your own personal story. I think it's probably something very important that we haven't really touched on all that much in the past on the podcast. So thank you in advance for the open conversation I'm sure we're about to have. First off, how has life been at the moment? Because as we've been saying beforehand, the world's a bit different to what it was 3-4 months ago now, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on and chatting. Yeah, it's been bonkers, really. It's been a big period of change for me, like it has been for everybody, particularly from a work point of view, because I spend most of my life travelling up and down the country, delivering sessions in schools mainly, and suddenly schools were shut, so I couldn't do that. I was working from home a lot more, which obviously had some benefits, but yeah, it was a big change. So I think I've just about got used to it now. Yeah, there's certainly been some good things to come out of it, but some challenging things as well. And from a personal point of view, with my kind of background and experience, it was going to present its own kind of unique challenges, if you like, with the sort of isolation and more time on my hands, a bit of boredom, etc. But thankfully things have gone pretty well.
Exactly, because like you say, it's something that's come up quite a lot, is what this particular period can do for someone's mental health. Because let's face it, being in the same place hour after hour, day after day, isn't great for someone's mental health. So I presume it's presented its own challenges for you right this minute as well, just like it has for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think generally people don't like change, and this was a big change. As I said, for me, a lot of it was kind of around having more time. Things like there being no sport to watch, which plays a big part of my life, no sport to play. Suddenly I got to fill that time and replace what that would usually give me. So things like that have been interesting. I think a lot of people have realized the importance of kind of putting your mental health at the forefront of everything during this time, looking after yourself and indeed the people around you. It's obviously been tough for someone like me who's very, very close to my family. I haven't been able to see lots of them. Luckily, I've got an amazing wife who I have the company of, but yeah, there's been different ways, but I think making sure that you kind of look after yourself and your mental health during this time and being aware of it is the main thing and has been the most important thing for me personally.
Exactly, like you say, the being aware of it really is so important. And before I then dive in to more of this and about your own story, I'll firstly mention essentially why the three of us are gathered on this call and why we're doing it. And we're all here for Max Hunter, who was a huge supporter of the Mintridge Foundation, who died by suicide in August 2019. He was 28. Max was a massive believer in using sport as a tool for positive change, exactly like you've just talked about, Patrick. And it has so much potential, as I think we all know, to boost your mental health. But it's, of course, not that simple to just simply open up about whatever it is that you might be struggling with. So that's why the Mintridge Foundation have created the Max Hunter Fund to encourage everyone to acknowledge their feelings on a regular basis. And this also coincides with the very special 28 Not Out event that's starting on July 10th, which we're also doing a live panel as part of that, featuring England Rugby International Dan Cole. And there'll be more details on that later on in the show as we go. But now then to, I suppose, the important part really of our chat, which is mental health, encouraging people to talk. And that's essentially what we're going to do today. So Patrick, first off, your story largely centres on gambling and gambling addiction and what that did to your mental health. First off, can you take us back to the time when you were working in London? I think it was an insurance, wasn't it? And that's when the gambling started to get out of control. What was it that sort of drew you into that in the first place?
Yeah, it's sort of interesting looking back. Seems like a long time ago, but also it doesn't at the same time. When I first started gambling, age 19, at university, having essentially never really placed a bet in my life before that, it was very much in a way that a lot of people would start to do something like that. It was fun. It was for entertainment. It was something that I did with my mates. I was pretty transparent about it. And then my relationship with gambling kind of changed quite quickly over a short period of time. I mean, I think there's definitely certain people that are more vulnerable than others. And I was one of those. I became hooked pretty quickly, I think. But then when I got released from Northamptonshire and my dream was over as a professional cricketer, dealing with that adversity was something that I didn't really know how I'd react to. I don't think anybody does. And I found that very, very challenging. And my way of dealing with it was to essentially run away from the problem and to find something else, a different outlet. And gambling provided me with that for various different reasons. Couple that with the fact that I was a very competitive person and it gave me that kind of feeling of winning and losing, instant response, instant reaction on tap. That's what really drew me into it. But again, I never really recognized the impact that it was having on anything other than finances. And at the time, I was fortunate in that money wasn't a problem because I'd been paid to play professional sport from a young age. And so therefore, I had more money than most people. Then when I went into the city and I was in London, and as you kind of alluded to, that's when things started to kind of escalate, or I started to lose control, as it were. And I put that down to the fact, really, that there were three things that contributed to that. One was the fact that I suddenly had access to more money because I was getting paid a very decent salary. I had more time and the opportunity to do it without somebody looking over my shoulder telling me what to do or what not to do, like I'd had a lot of the time. But also culturally, it was kind of part of the culture. It was something that people did. I became very motivated by money. And when I was gambling already, it was suddenly, well, gambling's a way to make even more money, which I now know was never a good kind of thought. But I think those three things put together were what really made things move in the direction that they did. And then obviously in December 2010, I had a huge win. I had a big win. And that sounds like the best thing that could ever happen to anybody, particularly a gambler. But actually, I now know that that was the worst thing that could ever happen to me because it made me more vulnerable. I thought I was invincible. And that completely changed my relationship with it.
when you were going through those initial times, as you were speaking about there, and the gambling grew more as you joined into that sort of culture with people that were doing it, was there ever any thought in your head that this was maybe spiraling, or was anyone sort of saying anything to you that sort of maybe warning you, or was it was just a case of you didn't think anything was happening, it was just part of everyday life?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, I naively only thought really about finance. So I only thought about money. I thought, well, if I've got enough money to do it, and I've got enough money to do what everybody else is doing, pay my bills and all that kind of thing, then it's not a problem. I didn't really think about anything else. I also only ever thought about myself. And I think looking back and reflecting on my addiction, it is, and gambling particularly, it's a very selfish addiction. And I only really thought about me. Well, if I'm okay, then that's okay. I think there was definitely the odd occasion where I would do something where I thought, well, hold on a second, that's not right. I've just spent hours in a betting shop when I should have been in a meeting with work, or I've suddenly been in a casino till 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning and I've got work the next day. But I didn't really kind of act on those sort of signs. I wish I had. I also kept things, I've always been a bit of a closed book. Well, up until now, I never talked about anything, and that was part of the problem, really. So I kept it all very secret from almost the very beginning. And I think that's sometimes one of the things that can be most dangerous, is when you're not open, you're not honest, you don't talk about it, because it's then very hard for anybody else to kind of give you the help or support, because you're trying to hide it all, essentially.
Well, there are almost two addictions there. I pick up on what you said about like how much you enjoyed the competitive action, the winning and losing in sport. Is it that sort of, I would kind of want to say addiction to the competitive aspect as well, that almost made the gambling go hand in hand with that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think gambling is a kind of drug for competitive people, because all my life I've been very competitive, and professional sport and sport to whatever level gave me that outlet. And suddenly when you took that away, I wasn't getting the same rush and buzz that I got from that. And gambling was actually the closest thing that I could find to it. But I think the problem for me was, when I was gambling, when I lost, I wouldn't stop until I won. And then every gambler thinks, well, when you win, you'll then stop. But actually, that's not the case, because everybody loves that feeling of winning. So you chase that. You lose more than you win, and you don't have to be too intelligent to work out what the consequences of that is. So I think, yeah, certainly that was kind of what drew me in and potentially made me even more vulnerable. So yeah, I mean, I think that's where I look back and I think, well, actually, I now realize I could have got that rush and buzz in a lot more different ways, and ways that might have had a positive impact on myself or other people. And I wish I had that understanding back then. And I guess that's kind of one of the motivating factors for me to do what I do now and share my experiences, so people can be more aware and make a kind of more informed decision, which I don't think I ever really did.
At the time then, when you said that your cricket career came to an end professionally, was there a lot of education, or was there a lot of help for that transition into normal life? Or was it back then it was very much that's the end of it, and you sort of left to deal with everything by yourself?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm honest, back then it was exactly as you just described it. There was essentially nothing. I now do a lot of work with organisations like the Professional Cricketers Association, who gave me a lot of support. And what they do now around that transition out of the game, if you like, is nothing short of phenomenal, both in terms of support but also preparation. I think what's strange is I didn't have a very successful professional sports career at all. I make no bones about it. But whatever level you play at some point, you've got to make that transition out of the game. And it's very, very difficult. And actually, sometimes for people that get a taste of it and are in it for a very short period of time, that transition can be harder because you kind of feel like there's a bit of unfinished business, sometimes a little bit of resentment. You kind of have regrets about not making the most of those opportunities. And actually, I underestimated the impact that that transition had on me. And I think, to be fair, a lot of people around me did as well. My family are incredible people. I've had a lot of support. But I think looking back, they wish they'd kind of maybe at that moment in time recognized how bigger moment that was and perhaps sort of provided me with even more support than they did.
What kind of impact do you think it had on your family at that time? I mean, because you say it's quite a singular activity, but obviously it's having effect on you, and there's probably things that your family can see that you didn't perhaps recognize at the time.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really hard is unless you're the person involved, you perhaps don't understand it. I mean, my dad was a very, very successful sportsman. He achieved an awful lot, so I guess he could see it a little bit more than perhaps some of the other members of the family. But I think for me, what was so hard about it is from such a young age, that was my dream. That was all I ever wanted to do. And I'd kind of put all my energy and efforts into it. And it was kind of the fact that overnight it was gone. One day I was a professional cricketer playing for Northamptonshire. The next day I'd been released and I suddenly wasn't. And I found that really, really hard. But also I think, unlike some people, one of the issues that I had throughout my kind of addiction, but also in dealing with that transition, was for whatever reason, I felt quite kind of embarrassed about the fact that I'd been released. I was so disappointed. I felt like I'd let people down. And I think everybody reacts slightly differently. But I think looking back, I think they now appreciate that I wanted it that badly, and when it was gone, that's hard to come to terms with. But I don't attribute any of the blame on what they did, or the way they sort of dealt with that situation, because I think I put on or gave the impression that actually I was absolutely fine and this and that, and so I think they trusted and believed me, which you can't criticize them for.
At that time, you said then there wasn't much support and it was very much an overnight transition, but was actually much known about gambling addiction at that time? Because it's something that media outlets have talked a lot more about in the last sort of year or so. But when that time came about, did people sort of really recognise the gambling addiction was such a big problem and just how bad it could get?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think I'm right in saying that I think it was only in about 2013 that gambling addiction was actually fully classified as a behavioural addiction. Before that, it was kind of seen as an OCD. Certainly when I was playing, there was lots of awareness programs about drugs, about alcohol, about other things. Nobody ever talked to me about gambling, and that was one of the things that motivated me to do what I do now, both in the professional sports sector but also in education, because I thought, well, actually, if I'd known about it, I might have made slightly different decisions. It was also, and it still is to an extent, a little bit of a taboo subject. There weren't that many other, whether it be high profile people or indeed anybody, who were talking about it and who were very open. And I think that really helps in kind of raising awareness. I would say now that's gone to the opposite extreme, which is great. People are much more aware of it. Obviously it's a hot topic, it's in the media, but I think that's really good. And I think that has been a really positive change for everybody. But certainly at the time, absolutely not.
At the time, and I asked this because it's a similar conversation I had with Alex Wallace, who, for anyone who doesn't know, is of course the Minchish Foundation's founder and director. And obviously hockey was her sport when she was growing up, and the fact that she didn't make the cut at national trial level, that's when she almost lost her identity of this, of Alex the hockey player, and that's who she was. Was there a sense of you essentially being Patrick the cricket player throughout much of your life? And once that was taken away, then it was just kind of you trying to re-find who you were, and then you ended up going down this path instead of...
Certainly to an extent. I think identity is played a part. I think for me, a lot of it was actually, I hadn't had to deal with too many challenges or failures whatsoever in life, and everything had kind of gone perfectly. Obviously, everybody has the odd kind of challenge or wobble, but most of them kind of pale into insignificance to what I faced in the real world, as it were. But I think dealing with that was the hardest thing for me, because I didn't really know how to deal with it and I didn't really like it. And so my way of dealing with it was to run away from it. I think also I realized that at the time, and I think to an extent you have to be a little bit, but at the time I was 19 years old, I'd been very high achieving. I was a professional sportsman. There's no two ways about it. I had an ego. And my pride had been dented severely, and that definitely played a part, because suddenly it was like, well, you're not as good as you think you are, and I didn't really like that. And I know that now, and obviously I'm much better for it. But at the time, when you're young, naive, I think you do have that ego, and when it gets hit, it's hard.
You're listening to Sportspiel, the Players Podcast.
How much, something you touched upon previously, how much is the education around things like that then changed for young athletes in recent years, and how much more provision and support are they given around potential transitioning, but also the you know, as something you mentioned before, just even having access to money and professional athletes. Like, I know I work with hockey players, and they, when they're not training, they do have quite a lot of spare time and time in which they could be doing gambling or things like that. So how much education and support now is there to help those athletes?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot more, and that's great. And actually, it's not just at the very top level. It's not just your kind of full-time professional players. The academy system are now focusing on that as well, which is brilliant, and I think is really, really important. I would say that when I was kind of in the system, the focus was very much, well, what's going on the pitch? And it was all about performance. It was all about training. And what have you got to do to reach that level? There was very little about what happens off the pitch. And I think what's great is the approach that a lot of organizations now are adopting is actually looking at the person as a whole, and the sportsman as a person, as it were. And I think that's great. I think also they realize that actually these people have the majority of their life beyond that career, and so that they've got to play a part in making sure that people are prepared for that. So I think the fact that there is more and more awareness out there, education programs for young athletes, for full-time professional athletes, I think one of the things that is difficult is that in some sports, that is kind of even more the case, and unfortunately often that boils down to money and funding, and so it's definitely harder for certainly individual sports. I don't know whether the support there is quite on the same level and as consistent across the board, but I can't really speak for a lot of other sports. But I think it's great what people are trying to do. And the fact that it's not just about on the pitch, it's off the pitch as well.
Moving on then into sort of the next stage of your life, and it comes after the your work in the city, where you then moved into teaching. I think it was your family who had also worked in teaching as well. But I read a bit about you where you essentially thought that move would curtail the gambling somewhat, but it didn't. Is there a reason you think it perhaps didn't pan out in the way you expected it to?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I made that transition for the wrong reasons, really. I made that transition because I thought it was a bit of an easy option. I knew no one would question why I was doing it because my family were all in it and people had always said, oh, you'll become a teacher. So no one was going to ask any questions, which was a good thing as far as I was concerned. I also thought that culturally, making that drastic change would mean that it wouldn't be part of the culture. I wouldn't have the same access to it, all those sorts of things. But actually, other than the first few months I was in it, that changed pretty quickly because suddenly I did have access to it because online gambling came into fruition. So I could do it on my mobile phone anytime, any place, wherever I wanted. Not just that, as a teacher, there were times, everyone knows you get nice long holidays, but that time then presented me with opportunity where I had lots of time to fill. And again, I used gambling as a way of doing that. So it was funny that actually what I thought would be the case perhaps was completely the opposite. It definitely did have some positive effects, but also from a financial point of view, after I won £35,000 from a bet one night, my problem now is every time I placed a bet, I thought I was going to win £35,000. So when I was earning less money, I was still putting on much bigger stakes because if I was winning £100 or £500, I thought, well, what's that? What's the point in that? It needs to be more and more. And of course, to gamble, you need money and it's all about affordability. And suddenly what was affordable was actually a lot less.
That was something I was going to bring up, that you mentioned how one big win sort of changed everything for you. Did it therefore have a really big change on your mindset? And did it change sort of your general approach to gambling and actually how you felt about it? Did you sort of stop enjoying it and feel that maybe it was more of a necessity, or did you still carry on enjoying it at the time?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think I talk about that being the point where my relationship was changed and it became like a drug, because almost from that day onwards, suddenly my behavior around gambling changed because I suddenly had all this money that I thought, well, I'll just gamble it away. I never told anybody I won that amount of money that night, and I actually lost it in 5 weeks. And that was when things just kind of spiraled out of control, because suddenly when it had gone, I wanted it back. I felt guilty, all these different things. And that kind of 6 week period, which then turned into 6 months before I left London, that's when it just was crazy. Because that was the point where it suddenly didn't start to be, it wasn't fun, because I was thinking, well, actually, I need to win this bet. I need to do this. We're talking about huge amounts of money. And that then started to create stress. It started to create anxiety. The wins were like this. The losses were even worse. And that's when it wasn't fun, to be honest. And that's when I guess it became a real problem.
Is that essentially the start of the journey, because which leads us down to suicidal thoughts, essentially? Because that, reading about your story, that seems to be like the rock bottom part of this entire episode, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the next kind of period of hole, and it kept getting deeper. I always thought I could get myself out of it because I'm that sort of person. And I thought I could deal with the problem myself. And actually, I now know that that isn't the case. I also always thought, from a kind of gambler's mentality, that I was only ever one big win away from getting myself out of this mess. But the more I chased that, sort of the worse it became. I think the big thing for me was, in terms of the mental health side of things, it just started to wear away at me. It didn't happen overnight, but actually living a secret life, living a double life, lying all the time, feeling guilty, it became very stressful. It was exhausting, and then add in the kind of financial stress. Also, I was essentially an insomniac. For 10 years, I didn't sleep because I was either up in the middle of the night sort of betting on anything that I could, like Hungarian handball. I was scrambling around the internet trying to find a loan, or couldn't sleep because I was so stressed and worried about what I was going to do, how I was going to gamble the next day, how I was going to pay back these people. It just wore away at me, to the point where actually I had had those thoughts for a long time. But it meant for me, I had to kind of hit rock bottom in order to really do something about it. One of my biggest regret, well, my biggest regret is that I had various different times and opportunities to do it. There was a couple of times where my parents tried to intervene and I could have been totally honest and I wasn't. And then there was other times where somebody else tried to intervene and I was very close to kind of letting my biggest secret out there, but I never did. And I now know it was always going to take me to hit rock bottom to do something about it.
So if you don't mind me asking, then what sort of was that worst moment, and how did you reach out to someone, and who did you reach out to?
Yeah, I mean, at that point in my life, I knew it was only a matter of time. I'd got away with so much stuff. It was only a matter of time before I got found out in one way or another. And I didn't quite know how that was ever going to manifest itself. But essentially, because of the things that I was doing, the way I was compromising my position professionally as a teacher, I got called in by the school, who basically said, look, we now know you've been doing things that you shouldn't do. And I found out there and then that I was going to lose my job. I was going to lose my house because I lived in school accommodation. And there was also a very real threat, if you like, of legal action, which might result in me going to prison. As if that wasn't enough to kind of stir me into action, I then had a period of time where I thought, well, I'll get myself out of this mess very quickly. And I tried to gamble my way out of it because it was all I knew. I borrowed a significant sum of money off somebody that I knew, and basically tried to chase all my debts in a short period of time. And I was under time pressure because when it was going to get announced by the school at the end of that Easter term that I was losing my job, well, everybody would know about it. I tried to gamble my way out of it. I got up to about £50,000 during the Cheltenham Festival in 2018. And I basically said to myself, I'm either going to win this money by putting a £50,000 bet on a horse, or I'm going to lose it and I'm going to kill myself. The horse came second, which I now know is the best thing that will ever happen to me. But obviously at the time, it really didn't feel like it. Suicide is an awful thing. It's an extraordinary thing. When I was in that position, I genuinely thought it was the best thing I could do, not just for myself, but for everybody else. I didn't really know how to do it, thankfully, because that was probably the thing that actually stopped me, was kind of panicking and not knowing how to do it. I initially tried to do it or think about doing it by overdosing. I then thought about driving my car off the road, but then I ended up at a train station. And was about to throw myself in front of a moving train before I reached out to my younger brother. I think I reached out to my brother because it was kind of my last chance. Fortunately, he answered that call, albeit in the form of a message. He replied to me, and what he said saved my life, because it stopped me doing it, because it was the first time in an awful long time that I finally thought about other people, not just myself. And he kind of stressed the impact that that might have on him, but also the fact that I could talk to him about anything. And that was what I really needed to hear. And that stopped me doing it. I get asked a lot, if your brother hadn't replied, would you have done it? Thankfully, I don't know the answer to that, and I never will. But he did, and that's the main thing. But actually, suicide prevention is a real passion of mine for very obvious reasons. But actually, one of the things that I do understand is that psyche, in that people think, well, why on earth would somebody do that? Actually, I think it's often because they don't think there's any other option, but also because they genuinely believe that the world will be a better place without them. Unless you're in that situation, unless you've ever been there, it's very hard to understand or comprehend. But I now do. And I think the most important thing that I can do is try and relay my message and my story to stop people who are ever in that situation doing it, because it really is the worst possible thing that can happen.
It sums up really how much of a hold it had on you, and just how complex and an issue it is to deal with as well. And what particularly strikes me is that through all the stuff that you were going through, you still had so much effort in keeping it a secret from everyone and keeping it to yourself. It's almost like the ego that you mentioned you had when you were younger is still kind of at play here, and you didn't want to admit another failure, if that's fair to put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, you've hit the nail on the head there. I think where gambling is such a dangerous addiction, I wouldn't wish any of the others upon my worst enemy, but why it's so dangerous is the fact that you can hide it. That's been escalated by the fact that you can now gamble online. So you can do it through your mobile phone. Everybody spends their life on the mobile phone. No one ever questions it, other than putting on perhaps a bit of weight and sometimes looking tired. There weren't so many visible signs to other people, so it was much harder for other people to intervene. I became a master of disguise, and I'm not proud of that, because the things that I was doing were awful, but I always found a way to cover it up. And that in itself weirdly became a bit of a drug, because it was almost like a game for me. How long can you keep this going? How effectively can you do it? And unfortunately, I was very good at it. I wish I hadn't been, because then maybe something would have happened sooner. But yeah, I think that's what's really terrifying about it, is the fact that I lived a life essentially for 13 years, and on the face of it, I had a successful career, a loving family, I was doing pretty well. But actually, underneath it all, it could not have been further from the truth. But no one, obviously people did, but no one could really tell or put their finger on what it was.
Mentioned there about how good you were at the secrecy and how that became a drug. When you did open up to your brother and for that first time, did you then find that you were all of a sudden being a lot more open with people, or did you still find that difficult, and did it take a bit of time to learn to open up to people?
Yeah, I mean, I went into rehab. So I spent essentially 4 weeks in rehab before having sort of aftercare and therapy beyond that. That was what that process was all around for me, was I'd been very much a closed book all my life. I never really talked about anything, particularly things that weren't going well in my life or anything that could potentially show a chink in my armor or any sign of weakness. I'd never talked about anything like that. And I was kind of, if you like, forced to. When I was in rehab, but in a very safe environment and amongst professionals and people that had been there and lived it. And that process allowed me to kind of do that. Then when I came out of it, I realized how much of a medicine that had been for me, and how great the impact it had, how much better it had made me feel being open. I suddenly thought, well, actually, maybe this is a better way of living my life. I also had a burning desire to kind of share my story, not because I think I'm a hero who's going to change the world, because I'm not proud of what I did and I never, ever will be, but actually because I thought, well, I now understand how easily it can happen. But also, if it can happen to me, who, as I said, on the face of it, had everything you could possibly want, then I thought, well, it could happen to anybody. And actually, one of the biggest mistakes, if not the biggest mistake I made, was thinking, well, it doesn't happen to people like me. It won't happen to me. And actually, it did. And that's why I wanted to do it. And now I've kind of gone down the opposite route. I am very open, very honest, and I much prefer being that way. And if it helps me and it helps other people, then it's a win-win situation.
Definitely. And it looks like you got a lot of help, as you mentioned at the start, from the Professional Cricketers Trust as well. But I mean, were you aware that that support was even on offer at the start and you had that option to turn to?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I was a member of the PCA, Professional Cricketers Association, as a result of playing professional sport, having a professional contract. I assumed wrongly that basically that was in place until the day you weren't a professional cricketer. I didn't really know that existed. The PCA now do a lot more work around that. And that support is essentially I'm there for life. It wasn't until I was in rehab that I was aware that I could still speak to them and reach out to them, and I did. And their support for me from that moment on was nothing short of incredible. They treated me as if I was captain of England. And that's the greatest compliment I can pay them. They're now doing a lot more work around making sure people are aware that that remains the case, even if you drop out of the game. But yeah, I mean, I try not to look back and have too many what ifs and if onlys, because otherwise I'd spend the rest of my life beating myself up. But actually, I think to myself, if I'd known that that support was there, would I have done something about it earlier? Quite possibly. But what they do and the work that they do with past and indeed present players in terms of the support network they provide you is incredible.
At what point did you make the decision, or did it sort of come into your mind that you wanted to take your story out there and to help other people? Was it quite immediate, or did that take a bit of time?
I mean, weirdly for me, the way I did it was, whilst I was in rehab, I wrote a blog, and it was essentially a much easier, I found it much easier to articulate what I'd been doing, the way I was feeling and what this process was about on paper than through words. I then shared it with initially just kind of those very close to me, and it had a profound impact on them. And they said, look, you need to sort of get this out there in the open because it's very powerful. So I then shared it with a slightly sort of wider network of people who said the same thing. And I thought, well, actually, maybe everyone's got a point here. I also thought to myself, what on earth am I going to do? Who's going to employ me? So this might provide me with the opportunity to do that. So it was actually a lot quicker than I thought it ever would be. But the company that I now work for, Epic Risk Management, kind of full time, I reached out to the CEO of the company who'd been through his own experiences, and he obviously recognized that I had a powerful story and a message that was important to tell. But the best bit of advice he gave me was, look, you need to look after yourself before you start trying to look after other people, tell them what to do. And so that period beyond rehab was really, really important for me in terms of getting my own two feet back on the ground, really, without relying on everybody else.
Make sure you follow Sportspiel on social media. Search for Sportspiel Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or on LinkedIn. I suppose it's one thing sharing your story with other people, but what about sharing your story with your family as well? Because they're the ones that are closest to you. And certainly to me, that would strike me as perhaps the hardest part of your recovery as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the day after I kind of hit rock bottom, I had to sit around a table with three of the most important people in my life and basically tell them everything. But when I say tell them everything, I was telling them about the debts that I had, the money that I owed, the fact I was about to lose my house and job, not the kind of real nitty gritty and what had been going on for the last 13 years. So actually, I had to think quite carefully about how I did that as well, because of how they might perceive it. And actually, one of the things that's really difficult is my parents immediately attributed a lot of blame on themselves. I mean, I would never attribute an ounce of blame on them. But yeah, it was tough. Most of them have now heard me speak and the kind of full story. They're fully aware of everything. But yeah, it is hard. And I think one of the strangest things about it is that actually people always think about the money, and I've still got a huge amount of debt. But it's not the money, and it's not the impact that finance had that kind of eats me up every day or affects me every day. It's the impact that I had on them. And I think I will never forgive myself, but they've forgiven me a lot quicker than I'll ever forgive myself.
Is that something that, as you mentioned earlier, there's still, in terms of the awareness of gambling addiction and everything, it's still very new and there's still a lot that isn't spoken about? And is the impact on the family of the person who has the addiction, is that something that potentially needs a bit more understanding and there needs to be a bit more of awareness of as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think by us or by people sharing their stories and talking about the impact on family members or affected others, I think that has a significant impact, because as I said with me, it's when you start looking away from just you and realizing that actually what you're doing is impacting on other people. The impact I had on them, not just financially, emotionally. You don't want to do that. And sometimes we get people who reach out to us for help because it's that element, as you've just said, that makes them realize that they need to stop what they're doing, not because of themselves, but because of other people. I think one of the biggest things with gambling that I hope changes and I think needs to change is it's now so normalized. It's so ingrained in culture and society. And yet it's still a little bit of a taboo subject. I say to people, actually, one of the things that's really hard about being a gambling addict is often if you say that you're an alcoholic or a drug addict, people's response might be that they feel sorry for you. If you're a gambling addict, people think you're an idiot. And that needs to change, because that's often the barrier that stops people from doing something about it, is that they think, well, because it's gambling, I don't want people to know. And I think that has to change. Otherwise, there are just going to be a lot more kind of horror stories.
And speaking of barriers and stigmas, I suppose, does the mental health side of it play a part as well? Because for so long, it's been a stigma that people have been trying to change for quite a few years, but particularly on the male side as well, it's that barrier is still there a lot of the time. And that if you're a man, you kind of feel you have to have that stiff upper lip sort of mentality and just plow on through. And perhaps that needs to change in society as well.
100%. I think it definitely is changing, and it has changed for the better in the last few years. And that's great. I think there is a lot more kind of coverage, if you like, around it. There are a lot more people speaking about it, which is brilliant. I still think there's some way to go, but I think by people talking about it, hopefully it kind of presents positive role models in that sense. But also I think that actually we need to kind of redefine what it is to be strong. I always thought being strong was not showing any weakness or not showing any vulnerability. But actually now I'm a big believer in actually showing vulnerability is a sign of strength and courage. And so I think that's part of the kind of battle is redefining what it is to be strong. And also, I think also understanding that mental health is a very complex thing, and everybody is very different. But the one common denominator in a kind of finding a medicine for it is talking about it. That helps almost everybody. Talking to people who are in the same situation or a similar situation helps. Trying to deal with it yourself is never, ever the kind of solution or going to solve the problem. And so I think that's really, really important. And if I can play my own small part in that, then amazing.
Yeah, and it's a difficult one because obviously this is a societal change that's needed and needs to be brought about. But is there something in potentially, you know, teaching, looking at the youth and just even making them feel more comfortable and feel like it's acceptable to open up and talk about their feelings, not for any particular mental health thing, but just to ingrain that in children that it is okay if you're having a bad day to just tell someone about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is exactly what needs to happen. I think it just needs to be normalized. I think it's a generalization, but I think it's true that men find it harder than women. And I think the more we can kind of instill that mentality in young men, in everybody really, from a very young age, that it is normal to talk about how you're feeling, to say that you're not having a great day and that you're not okay. Then actually when you get older and you become an adult, it's then just what you do. I think that's part of the problem, is a lot of people then encounter that problem when they get a bit older and they suddenly think that they can't. So I think the more we can do, the more we can work with young people around it. I think also it's getting that message to people that there's a lot out there about looking after your physical health, and I didn't for a long time. Looking after your physical health is so important, to be healthy, to eat well, to do exercise. But actually looking after your mental health, this being the most powerful part in your body, actually that message is equally important. Let's put the two side by side. Let's not say one is more important than the other. Let's just say they're both really important. So yeah, I think there's a lot of good things going on, but I think there's a long way to go.
Exactly. And it feels like we're essentially at the start of this journey to try and push for the changes that so many have been calling out for. I'll lastly touch on the online gambling side of things, because it's something you alluded to, and the ease of access, really, that you can just, you know, open up an app on your phone and then it's there. And this is something we've talked about on the show before, and quite a lot of people have talked about, is the sheer number of adverts that there are out there at the moment on TV for live sporting events. Taking football as an example, so many teams have a gambling sponsor on their shirts and things like that, and it's constantly put in people's faces, whether you're a gambling addict or not. Is that something that we seriously need to look at changing? Because I imagine we're getting to the point now where if you are a gambling addict, the temptation when you are seeing these adverts put out so frequently can be difficult to ignore a lot of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, firstly on mobile phones, I think that has kind of changed the world in lots of different ways, some of them incredibly positive. But when it comes to gambling, I don't think it's changed it in very many positive ways, because of the accessibility that you have. I think you can place a bet in 6 seconds on over 2,500 different platforms. So the access that you have, it's there. It's a click of a button. It lives in your pocket. And the problem with that is when it becomes a problem, or when you lose control, you never get away from it. You can literally never get away from it. And I found that really, really difficult. I think also the younger generation are brought up in a kind of generation where everything is about click of a button, instant response, instant reaction. And gambling and to an extent gaming give you those things, so it appeals to young people. I think when it comes to adverts, I think we all know that there's too many gambling adverts. It's everywhere. You can't really get away from it. Where I have a kind of fundamental issue with it is A, if it's kind of predatory in nature, but B, if it's people are exposed to it that shouldn't be. I don't really see how something can be illegal to people of a certain age, and yet it's kind of rammed down their throats. And that doesn't just refer to kind of TV advertisements. I'm thinking more if you now play on some of these games, you'll get pop-ups to gambling companies and things. And I don't think that they need to do that either. I think enough people are going to gamble. Most people are aware of it. We don't need to kind of ram it down people's throats. I think we have seen some positive changes, and I think we'll see some more. But again, I think there more needs to be done. And I think there's been some positive steps in regards to kind of trying to disassociate kind of sport with gambling a bit, because I think that's one of the big issues I've got, is it's almost like now in society you can't watch sport and enjoy it unless you've got a bet on it. And actually, that's not a message that people should be hearing. So I think things like the whistle-to-whistle ban on adverts and things like that will have a positive effect. But yeah, there's still a long way to go.
And one of the, I suppose, the other issues, not so much with the advertising, but something I've certainly picked up on with reading, is the direct advertising through emails to people who have signed up. And that strikes me as something that needs to be looked at as well when you are constantly bombarded with these offers through email direct to you, the customer. And again, it almost compels you to take part so that you feel part of something.
Yeah, I think often it's the kind of frequency of it, quite relentless. And I think that is not good. I don't think anybody needs that. I think we need to make sure we do as much as we can to, from a very young age. And as I said, it's hard for people to believe, but I'm not anti-gambling. I don't think it's the devil. I don't think it's evil. I use the analogy that it's like being an alcoholic and coming out of rehab and trying to shut down every pub in England. It's not the solution, and it's also not the right thing to do, because there's a lot of people that can enjoy it for the right reasons. But I think more needs to be done to recognize A, how addictive it is, B, well, we need to make sure that people understand what happens when you lose control and what you can do about it. Just be more aware of the dangers and pitfalls of it, really, which I don't think a lot of people are when they enter into a relationship with it.
What is your relationship with gambling now?
Obviously, I work in the industry because I talk about it. I don't work for a gambling company or a gambling operator. So I'm exposed to it in the sense that I'm always talking about it. I'm very aware of what's going on. I don't gamble in any shape or any form, and haven't since my last bet on the 22nd of March 2018. So my intention is to never place another bet in my life. It obviously comes in all sorts of different forms and guises, so you have to be kind of very aware of that. I think I now take full responsibility for what happened. I kind of adopt a mentality that if a doctor said to me, if you have a cigarette, you're going to die, I would like to think I wouldn't have a cigarette. And I kind of adopt that mentality. But I can never be complacent, because it's not something that goes away. It's something that will live with me forever, and I have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. But every day that goes by, that gets easier. Of course, there's always the temptation because so many of my mates still do it. People talk about it. We've just talked about adverts and all those sorts of things. So there's always going to be that temptation. But I know that some people can and some people can't, and I can't. And I also know that my life's a lot better without it. Ironically, I've still got huge amounts of debt, but I've got more money than I've ever had because I'm not gambling. So that's proof in itself that I don't need it as part of my life.
And have you found then that actually sort of working, you say working in the industry and working, talking about gambling and being aware of it actually has helped you? Because obviously it would be completely understandable if you moved away from it completely and wanted nothing to do with it. But the fact that you are sort of still aware of what's going on, do you think that that is helping you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think partly because of the nature of the way I do it, by sharing my story, I'm talking about basically what life was like when I was doing it and how bad it was. So it's a constant reminder of where I was and where I don't want to be again. That is a kind of form, it's quite cathartic, it's a form of therapy for me. And the fact that it helps me and it helps other people, then I think I've got the best job in the world. Similarly with my work with the Mintridge Foundation, again, kind of reinforcing that message to young people, making them realize that actually you made mistakes, you did things that you regret, and you don't want them to do the same, is really positive for my own kind of self-esteem and my own recovery. And I feel like I'm giving something back after taking an awful lot away. And that helps in my own recovery.
Exactly. And to round this off, basically, you touched on it there, the very important work that the Mintridge Foundation does in educating young people through sport. And I think the work that you've particularly been doing on the gambling side of things is it's really helping, and perhaps is something that is, I suppose, largely absent, really, and something that has needed addressing for a fair amount of time. And finally, we're actually getting to that stage now where young people are having their eyes opened, really, to the what it could do to you and how it could change your life. But I think both me and Will probably say the exact same thing. There's one thing knowing there's an issue, but there's one thing hearing about the issue from someone who's been there firsthand. And I find the chat that we've just had incredibly powerful and eye-opening to the actual dangers and what an addiction like that can do to your life. So huge credit to you, Patrick, for opening up in the way you have and continue to do, to highlight just what an impact it can have on your mental health and how important opening up is as well.
Well, thanks very much. I mean, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I think obviously the two organizations that are closest to my heart, because the ones I kind of work for, Epic Risk Management from a gambling point of view in the work that we do, and then obviously the Mintridge Foundation as a charity. Both those organizations kind of sit, everything that they do just resonated with me, which is why I wanted to be involved in them. And I think that the work they do is nothing short of phenomenal. And I know that if I'd had access to those things when I was younger, I'd like to think things would have been a bit different. And so if I can be part of that and play my own part in changing that and shaping futures, then that's great. And I think the work that you guys are doing through the podcast and stuff is awesome. So thanks very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Once again, a massive thank you to Patrick for being such a fantastic guest and for speaking so eloquently about what is a very difficult topic. Both Alistair and myself learned a lot by listening to him, and we look forward to seeing the continued change he and many others will hope to bring about. Thank you also to the Mintridge Foundation for setting up the interview, and make sure you check out their social media channels to see the great work they're continuing to do across the country, including the 28 Not Out Max Under Fund. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with another episode. And in the meantime, make sure you follow us by using the handle @SportsBuellPod across Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.